The following audio file was recorded on April 8th in Nashville, Tennessee by Earnhardt Productions Incorporated at a voting rights and election reform conference titled Gathering to Save Our Democracy. It has been uploaded to this site courtesy of the January 30th Coalition, an Ohio-based voting rights group which endorsed the conference. You are welcome to copy and distribute or broadcast this recording. Please also consider making a donation to Radio for All so that recordings like this one can continue to be made available.
Fellow patriots, my name's John Michael Fortune, and I'm mad as hell to report that my fellow Georgia citizens were the first in this country to be disenfranchised as an entire state. Georgia's statewide implementation of the paperless Diebold voting system, which by design provides a voting experience free of cumbersome details like physical evidence of your vote. There are a number of organizations in Georgia working to bring back the voting franchise to Georgia citizens and beyond. Citizen groups, including our own group, Defenders of Democracy, our allies Count the Vote, Count Paper Ballots, and others have been tackling a multitude of strategies to expose improprieties in Georgia's voting system, to collect evidence of unethical and illegal practices, to pass legislation, and to restore ethical and moral standards as the standards by which voting is practiced. Defenders of Democracy in particular is embarking on a grassroots education, grassroots organizing effort, and legislative efforts including drafting legislation and lobbying for ethical legislative relief. Defenders and our organizational allies have been coordinating our legislative efforts with a coalition of third parties such as the Greens, Libertarians, the Constitution Party, in a group called the Voter Choice Coalition, or VCC. The primary focus of the VCC for the past 2 years has been to pass paper ballot legislation. The VCC last year got a paper ballot bill passed in Georgia's Senate with the strong backing of Georgia's Senate Republicans. Georgia's Senate Democrats circled the wagons around Georgia's Democratic Secretary of State, Kathy Cox, and voted in a block in an attempt to kill our bill. Secretary Cox's pride and joy, the Diebold voting system, was introduced through her efforts as well as the efforts of others who seek to implement evidence-free paperless voting. Some citizens have questioned the motives of the Georgia Republicans in their efforts to pass legislation to remedy the evidence-free voting system. The VCC and Defenders of Democracy welcome any party's successful passage of meaningful, ethical legislation. The ideas that inspire meaningful legislation come from many sources, and I'm going to summarize the essence of Mark Sawyer's paper, Reframing the Issue of Electronic Voting. Elections belong to the people. Elections belong to the people, not election officials and not to computer programmers like myself, nor to private corporations, nor technicians of any description. The proper role of elections administration is to assist the people in the conduct of their own elections. Our elections cannot be privatized, and election outcomes must be based on evidence of voters' intent. The other concept that is required is that elections require an unbroken chain of citizen custody of the vote. That was endemic in the previous voting systems that were based on paper ballots, and by the removing of the paper, the citizen custody of the vote is broken the instant you press cast ballot on a paperless voting machine. Well, the Voter Choice Coalition came up with a solution to this system called the Vote Count Protection Act. And Unfortunately, Georgia's legislators haven't had the nerve to introduce a potent resolution to our current system. That act can be viewed in its entirety on Defenders of Democracy and the voterchoice.org website. I'd also like to give a brief summary of some of the efforts to collect evidence regarding the current implementation of evidence-free voting in Georgia. CountPaperBallots.org has put in many open records requests and received audit-worthy data in 28 of 159 counties. One of the interesting questions that comes to mind when reading the response to one of these open records requests is it a terrorist act for citizens to ask for election data that we are entitled to by Georgia law? Well, evidently the Secretary of State's office feels so because they wrote back to us that disclosure of the information requested would compromise security against sabotage or criminal or terrorist acts, and the disclosure of which is necessary for the protection of life, safety, or public property. As a computer programmer of more than 20 years' experience, I can't think of any program that I wrote that was used commercially that was less complicated than it would be to write an elections management program. And the statement that it would compromise our national security is absurdist on its face. In summary, I would just like to reveal two other pieces of evidence that have come forth in Georgia. Georgians were supposedly training their election workers to use Diebold voting equipment when six DRE machines were stolen, and then there was a subsequent denial of the theft of these machines, which also included a GEM server where the votes are tabulated at the county level. However, we do have a police report, and despite the cover-up and subsequent videotape documentation of confessions from the same Secretary of State's office, which stated that no theft occurred. Also, it's not uncommon for the Secretary of State to certify election results that are mathematically impossible. And we can give you plenty more details if you come speak to us in person. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My name is Mary Beth Kuznick, and I bring you greetings, and I bring you some wonderful news from the Keystone State of Pennsylvania, where just yesterday afternoon, about 3 o'clock, we received word that our Secretary of State, Pedro Cortez, has decertified the Unilec Patriot machines for use in Pennsylvania. Now, I will be speaking a little bit more about the problems with the Patriot in Pennsylvania later, but at this time, I think congratulations are due to the grassroots activists who, they had several groups who worked for months, literally months, to bring this about, even prior to the election of 2004. And these groups would be the American Voter, which was founded by Sheila Green of Beaver County, and the Mercer County Citizens for Better Government, which is led by Kathy McPherson and her husband, Mark. And again, these people have worked tirelessly to bring this about. Pennsylvania had a very interesting election in 2004. I sit here and I hear these reports and I could probably just rubber stamp them and say that was Pennsylvania. But we had some unique problems as well. Our exit polls were off by approximately 5%. We were second only to the state of Florida in the so-called incidents reported to the EIRS, the 1-866 Our Vote hotline. We had over 4,500 incidents reported. Ohio folks, we beat you. These were people that called in with a problem. Could be something with their registration. It could be a voter intimidation issue. Somebody was harassing them at the polls. It was basically a hotline to report voter concerns. And we had 4,500 plus incidents. The election of 2004 was unprecedented in Pennsylvania. We had unprecedented new registrations. We had unprecedented participation. There were rallies. There were more yard signs than you ever saw before. We also had unprecedented partisan politics. I personally lost my wonderful progressive state senator, Alan Kukovich, when he went down to defeat in one of the most dirty, lie-filled elections ever held in the state of Pennsylvania, and he was targeted for that defeat by his opponent and the opponent's party. Now, so again, Pennsylvania 2004 was a buggy load of election problems, and I would like to invite you to get on our little Pennsylvania Dutch Amish buggy and take a little tour. We had long lines. We had changed polling places shortly before the election, 4 or 5 days before. They said it was due to accessibility issues. They didn't know this before 5 days before the election. And these were in Democratic areas mostly. We had lost Democrat registrations. And of course, we had the usual not enough provisionals, and where there were DREs in use, no emergency ballots. So again, we had voter suppression and coercion, and I probably should combine the intimidation with that. We had some very unique, I'll try to pick my three or four most unique things that we had. In one county, or one precinct in Beaver County, they did not have any emergency ballots, as I said. So the voters were asked to take a piece of legal paper or typing paper, fill out their votes, and the judge of election stated that she was sworn to do this, and at 10 o'clock that night when the machines came back up, she would enter the people's votes for them. If they wanted to watch, they could pay her $10 for the privilege of coming to watch this process. In Washington County, in Washington County, the Democratic Director of Elections, who is known to be a good and concerned director, decided to have some new telephone lines installed to the Board of Election office to handle a judge of elections calling in about registration, various things that happen on election day. These lines on election day morning miraculously rang in the Child Services office. And this matter was not able to be corrected all day. In fact, election protection attorneys had to stand outside the two offices and relay messages back and forth with cell phones. The cause was later determined to be technician error. One young man reported that he was in line waiting to vote in Mercer County, and he was approached by a woman he thought was a poll worker. And she said, may I see your voter registration card? So he showed it. And she said, oh, sir, you're in the wrong line. You need to move over. So he went to the next line, got to the head of the line, and learned that he was not in the correct line and had to vote on a provisional. He was not given an opportunity to go back. And he later learned that this so-called poll worker was a Republican committee woman. She was an attorney, and she knew darn well that she had no business interfering with a voter waiting in line to vote. I believe we had some visits from the mighty Texas Strike Force, because the most glaring, to me, issue that happened, or incident that happened, is that some group from out of state approached the Old Order Amish in Northwest Pennsylvania. These are very gentle, peace-loving, private people. They don't get involved politically unless it's under great duress. These people were told that they needed to come and register and vote for George W. Bush, because if they did not and the Democrats got in, the Democrats would kill their children and steal their guns. Amish don't even use guns except for hunting and to protect protection against the rabid animals and stuff. It's ridiculous. Okay, real quickly, the Unilek Patriot, the machine problems. The Unilek Patriot was only in use in three very small counties. And in those three counties, Green, Mercer, and Beaver, we believe that it cost nearly 10,000 precious votes. Traditionally, in Pennsylvania, the presidential undervote, this is people that did not select any candidate for president, is approximately 1 to 3%. I know in my own poll this year, where I'm a poll worker, we had a 0% undervote on lever machines. On the DREs, the Patriot, you know, like Patriots, we had a 4.5% undervote in Greene County, a 5.25% in Beaver, and a 7.29% in Mercer County. But in some precincts, those undervotes were as high as 70% and 80% in the Farrell First Precinct, Second Ward. The officials in these counties blame voter error and lack of voter education. Always we blame the voter. The two grassroots organizations that I mentioned earlier worked for months to get this issue brought to the light, and they, to Mercer's credit, their county did produce a report. They had a bipartisan or multipartisan commission. It is a 30-page report. They did not have subpoena power, but they were able to document their problems. This was submitted to our Secretary of State in conjunction with the Beaver County citizens. And the recertification hearing was held in February. During that hearing, the Unilek Patriot machines failed repeatedly, even when being operated by the president of Unilek. So where we stand right now, real quickly, I know I'm running over time, the Unilek machines have been decertified. We don't know exactly how that will proceed, but we do know that our primary election on May 17th, these counties will be voting on hand-counted, hand-marked paper ballots. Our governor has appointed a task force, and to his credit, he has included representatives from Common Cause and other groups as opposed to just the traditional political parties. And we do have a very active and emerging grassroots election rights and reform movement. So our challenges now are to get voter-verified paper ballot legislation. This is going to be a hard fight because our legislature is not known for being technologically advanced. We are one of only 14 states that has no such legislation even brought up to the legislature yet. We need to keep our citizen groups, our poll workers, and our voters motivated. People poured their hearts into this election, and I know many of you did. And when things went the way they did, a lot of people are bummed. I'm not going to do this anymore. And we have to find a way to draw them back in and let them know that we're going to fight to make their votes count. And finally, Pennsylvania is going to have to work to stay blue. And I don't say that to be partisan. Pennsylvania comes from a long tradition, was founded by Quakers. It comes from a tradition of social justice, live and let live, and peaceful activism. And although we may change, and we obviously have elements of both red and blue in our state, I believe at our core we are a blue state, and we are targeted. I know we are targeted, and I fear, and you mark my words, we may be the next Ohio or Florida in 2008. So I would refer all you folks to our website. It's www.votepa.us. We're going to try to post these Unilek documents and so forth as it becomes available. And I thank you all very much. Stand with us. Help us fight to keep our right to vote, all of you in our sister states. And God bless the United States of America.
I'm Sharona Merrill. I am a co-founder of the National Ballot Integrity Project and a co-founder also of New Hampshire Ballot Integrity Task Force. I'm going to update you a little bit on New Hampshire. First of all, we are a blue state, as it happens. Kerry did win up there, and we also have a Democratic governor. However, we are not at peace with our voting system. Let me tell you a little bit of what's going on. First of all, we had two Republican operatives who have been indicted and sentenced, albeit lightly. For phone jamming of the Democratic Get Out the Vote efforts on Election Day, November 2002. Former executive director of the state Republican Party was sentenced in March to 7 months in prison for jamming Democratic telephone lines during the 2002 general election. Chuck McGee pleaded guilty in federal court to conspiring to make anonymous calls to harass and annoy. He was also fined $2,000 and ordered to perform 200 hours of community service. He had faced up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Although he admitted no wrongdoing at the time of his arrest, he later admitted paying $15,600 to a Virginia telemarketing company that hired another business to get out the vote phone banks around the state, generating more than 800 calls lasting about an hour and a half and disrupting firefighter union phones. Actions of this nature strike at the core of the democratic process, Judge Joseph DeClerico said. On February 8th, Alan Raymond, who headed GOP Marketplace, hired by New Hampshire Republicans for election-related telemarketing services, pleaded guilty last summer to one count of conspiring to make harassing phone calls. After apologizing to the U.S. District Judge Joseph DeClerico, a sentence was imposed, including a $600 fine. $15,600, a slap on the wrist, but a slap nonetheless. As we know, a Nader-Camejo recount took place in New Hampshire in November of 2004. Ralph Nader, to his credit, stood in the gap where John Kerry was absent. He was effectively in hiding on recount deadline day. So Ralph Nader stepped up to the plate. Okay, so as we know, the statistical analyst Ida Briggs had identified 72 areas in New Hampshire with anomaly swings to the GOP, which were reported at 5 to 15% out of trend, indicative of flipped vote patterns. It's interesting to note that most of these areas use the Diebold AccuVote OS optical scan machines. Of those 72 areas, 11 key areas were selected by the Nader campaign for recount, and the ballots were requested about a week in advance. They're paper ballots, optical scan. Of those areas counted, only minor variations were noted in the count. Mr. Nader's campaign praised New Hampshire for the fairness of its system, for its available hand-counted paper ballot recountability across the board, announced that it was satisfied with the results, and the recount was reported as completed. Through all of this, however, we felt something invisible was amiss in New Hampshire, but couldn't put our finger on it. So at this point, we just wrote up our experiences and quietly continued our investigations and looked to the next step in the election recount process, which was, at that point, anticipated to be Florida, Nevada, New Mexico, and Ohio. Now, previously, three key anomaly races have been identified in New Hampshire, including George Bush Sr. versus Bob Dole, 1988 New Hampshire presidential primary. The Gallup poll said Bob Dole was ahead of Bush by 8%. The official results, George Bush Sr. ahead of Dole by 9%, a total anomaly swing of 17%. Second anomaly race identified, Republican John E. Sununu, son of notorious John Sununu Sr., computer wizard, cited in Vote Scam Chapter 1, Electronic Hoodwink, versus popular Democratic Governor Jean Shaheen for New Hampshire Senate. Per a poll by the Concord New Hampshire Monitor newspaper on November 3rd, Jean Shaheen 47%, John Sununu 46%. Official results, Jean Shaheen, Democrat, 47%, John E. Sununu, Republican, 51%. Total anomaly swing, 5% to Republican Sununu Jr. Third race, Governor Howard Dean, Democrat, versus Senator John Kerry, Democrat, in the New Hampshire 2004 presidential primary. Results reported the night before votes were officially counted, according to the Assistant Secretary of State, whom I was speaking to, as he was saying, "We're not going to be counting these votes entirely till tomorrow afternoon." They were announcing the results of the election on the TV behind us. So that was very interesting. So anyway, the results were reported. John Kerry, 36%. Howard Dean, 24%. Now, regarding these Kerry-Dean figures, having hand-delivered a series of critical vote fraud-related information packages for 7 months from July 03 to February 04 to the presidential candidates on the campaign trail in New Hampshire, I witnessed the crowds early in the presidential race by the various campaigns, drawn by the campaigns. These figures by no means reflect what I saw out in the field. Howard Dean's crowds were electric and to capacity, with high energy, enthusiastic response, people pouring out the doors, fire inspectors keeping people out for overcrowding, hundreds showing up for these events. John Kerry's crowds, generally 60% of the turnout at best, response lukewarm, no problems with overcapacity crowds whatsoever. People would pretty much stand around, listen, and applaud politely, but no electricity like at Dean's events. Nowhere near the attendance of the hundreds and hundreds that turned out for Dean. So until, of course, Kerry was announced as the predicted winner in New Hampshire, then he was suddenly, in one day, the press behavior changed, and they began to stampede John Kerry. And I almost got trampled myself on that day. It was a very interesting story. So anyway, there was an awareness of Martin Bento's study, which many of us may know about, at onlinejournal.com, which occurred by February 10th or so of 2004. But that was almost 2 weeks after the primary and 11 days too late for a New Hampshire recount request. Lynn Landis wrote about this as well. Here's what was reported. In analyzing the data, comparing optical scan machine counts to paper ballot hand counts, a big disparity. We presently have Diebold AccuVote OS optical scanners and ES&S Optech OS optical scanners, as well as paper ballot hand counts in some of the more rural areas. What we saw was in the areas with ES&S Optech OS, a 14.7% spread was reported between Kerry and Dean, in Kerry's favor, of course. In areas with Diebold AccuVote OS, there was a 9.6% spread reported between Kerry and Dean. In areas with hand-counted paper ballots, the spread between Kerry and Dean was just 1.6%. Now, when I called Dean's campaign's headquarters in Vermont on February 10th, this was a full 2 weeks after the primary in New Hampshire, 3 days is the deadline for a recount request in New Hampshire. I called them with the Bento study information, and their reaction up there was quite interesting. They said this, "You are kidding!" It was too late to request a recount. Now, if there's any truth to the story about the 1.6% spread with the hand-counted paper ballots, it might have made a big difference in this last election. Why? Because had Dean's camp known about it sooner, within 3 days of the election, according to New Hampshire's current recount rules, they might well have requested a recount in New Hampshire. And had they done so, history might have been different. But unfortunately, we'll never know. So, just wanted to tell you about a mystery we have here in New Hampshire. Just to let you know that the jury is still out on the Bento data in New Hampshire. We're not convinced that demographics explain the data. But LHS, we have an ink impressions in New Hampshire. In fact, it's New England as well. This company services 5 New England states. And there's a lot of concern over this so-called independent company LHS Associates. It's located in Methuen, Massachusetts. It is, quote, pre-programming, configuring, and maintaining all of the voting machines for 5 New England states, including ES&S and Diebold optical scan in the state of New Hampshire. Now, interestingly, we have learned that LHS is also in the business of census demographic data collection, and it has such a contract with the state of Massachusetts and likely with others. We know for a fact Massachusetts. So a question arises, What is such a company doing engaging in census demographic data collection while pre-programming, configuring, and maintaining voting machines? That's a little odd, isn't it? So a similar curiosity is occurring about this in Vermont and Massachusetts. So further, we find out that this company is actually representing itself as Diebold. I happened to see this myself. I went to a conference in Boston. This guy was there. He represented himself as Director of Marketing Sales for AccuVote, Diebold AccuVote OS, and he hands me a card, and it's LHS. So what this means is we have a known-to-be-partisan private corporate vendor whose CEO, as we know, Wally O'Dell, promised to deliver Ohio to the president in 2004, independently pre-programming, configuring, and maintaining virtually all of New England's electronic voting machines, right? And collecting census demographic data. So what's wrong with this picture, okay? Yeah? Okay. So we also find that LHS, for a fee of approximately $300 to $500 per election period, billed directly to client communities, is pre-programming memory cards on-site at its location in Methuen, Mass., and delivering them directly to client communities in five New England states, including New Hampshire. This is evidently being done with no real meaningful oversight as to what software exactly is actually being programmed onto these memory cards during the performance of such services. It's our understanding that the companies providing similar such services exist throughout the country, such as ink impressions in the Southwest. For instance, okay, I had to mention that, yep. Some of these are being looked at similarly, but more scrutiny into these independent pre-programming organizations need to occur nationally with all findings compared and coordinated. So if somebody reliable would like to take this project on, please advise, because we could truly use some help with this. Now, just a second mystery in New Hampshire. Okay. We have another mystery in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, there seems to be some question as to whether we're using 1988 so-called pre-GEMS, non-GEMS, or GEMS software with Diebold AccuVote optical scanners, some of which have been acquired in the early 1990s. So we're advised we're using pre-GEMS or non-GEMS version 1.92T, a test version that's said to be full of holes and never should have been released. New Hampshire has also added the use of version 1.94W, which is firmware, which according to our assistant attorney general is considered controversial and may be discontinued. It's been suggested by high-level state officials that because we're not using GEMS in New Hampshire, we're exempt from the pitfalls of vote tampering and or central tabulation. Okay? Simultaneously, it's been reported that it cannot be the case, however, that we're using pre-GEMS or non-GEMS software with Diebold machines because one can't even get the votes out of the machines without the GEMS. So upon hearing this, a high-level New Hampshire state official was presented with the question, if we don't have GEMS in New Hampshire, and yet one can't even get the votes out of the machines without the GEMS, how can it be that we are pre-GEMS, non-GEMS, here in New Hampshire? So after a long pause, he replied, well, if that's the case, we certainly haven't been told. And so there's a missing piece of the puzzle, and the question remains, is the software LHS is utilizing in its pre-programming of optical scan and other voting machine memory cards and delivering directly to New England client communities perhaps a more recent and controversial version of GEMS itself? And if it is, could we in New Hampshire be subject to some sort of central tabulation after all? It is unknown to the voters and even to our own respected Secretary of State. Okay. Well, the National Ballot Integrity Project, in association with VoterGate, the film project, the New Hampshire Ballot Integrity Task Force, and Democracy for New Hampshire, filmed election 2004 in New Hampshire as exemplar to illustrate to America and the world what is precious and worthy of preserving in America's elections. However, I would like to just advise you that we are under tremendous assault in New Hampshire, as are many other states at this time. And we are, in fact, battling 158 bills in our legislature that deal with voting and elections. And I just want to let you know that we are advised from a reliable source that the Heritage Foundation and other such organizations are strategically seeding these bills across the state legislatures of the country and federally as well, as if to barrage us with busy work and to keep us all playing defense, and possibly in order to render us as a movement only minimally effective. So we should be aware of this, that while we're out there fighting off the windmills and corruption with these bills, they're busy deploying these voting equipment systems, voting systems across the country rapidly en masse for this so-called Help America Vote Act mandate that does not even exist. There's much more to report, but it's short on time. Thank you.
Well, unlike Ohio, Arizona wasn't even a battleground state. And yet, out in Tucson, we uncovered what appears to be a highly sophisticated scheme of old-fashioned ballot box stuffing. Okay, I'm Dave Griscom, and this is John Brakey, who is a Democratic cluster captain of four precincts belonging to Arizona Legislative District 27, which is part of Congressional District 7. And District 7 is predominantly Hispanic, 80% non-Republican, and the largest district in Arizona with this demographic mix. When John visited his four polling places on November 2, 2004 to inspect the voting process and to collect tear sheets, he was met with non-cooperation and even hostility on the part of election officials at three of them. This study wouldn't have been possible without John's having assembled on Excel spreadsheets public voter registration data, about 1,900 names, and all paper records of election day turnout to officially 883 at Precinct 324. Okay, you can't read this, and it's not intended that you do, only that you see that this is a balance sheet. It has nothing to do with statistics. It's a balance, and we've audited every one of these records. This is my result of the audit at the bottom. Again, just showing this graphically, you don't have to read it. The poll workers had their results over here. My results didn't match theirs, and I was auditing every paper record to say how many votes should have been cast, how many provisionals, how many at the polling place, etc. It turned out I had to modify my audit by a compulsory assumption that 38 ballots that should have been cast provisional were put into the optical scanner by the end of the day. And even so the regions of agreement then are in yellow, but even so we had regions of disagreement, and those discrepancies, I believe, are two other kinds of fraud that they perpetrated on the same day. Now to voting 101 here, we have a voter arrives at the table and he signs a signature roster. And this regular signature roster to vote at the polls contained 884 unique names, 844, excuse me. There is also a provisional ballot signature roster, and in this case it contained 39 unique names, so some of that is 883. Then the information is passed by ballot information slips back to the poll worker who fills out the consecutive number register. And these are hand-printed names. So we have signatures, we have hand-printed names, and there are 883 unique names hand-printed there, equal to the number of unique names over in the signature rosters so far. So the height of each one of these columns is proportional to the number of names it contains, so that those of you close enough to perceive these heights can have a sense of what's going on graphically. You don't have to understand the numbers. Now, it turns out that 48 unique name provisional voters actually signed the wrong roster here, undoubtedly by direction of the poll workers, since they couldn't know what to sign. They signed right next to their E's, some of these. That was an irregularity. Normally, the votes at the polling place are going to be passed into this Diebold AccuVote optical scanner, and I estimate 774 regular votes went in there. But there were more irregularities. 22 of the names on the CNR are not to be found on either roster. These are more unique names. And now you see on the left the gap between the signature roster and the provisional signature roster corresponds to those 22 on purpose. Now, that pushes the other signature roster up and creates 22 names on the signature rosters whose vote are not going to be counted here because of the names of the people who didn't sign. Another irregularity, 12 voters signed both rosters. I'm not quite sure what that means. Now, normally, the provisional votes are going to go into envelopes sealed and with affidavits signed on the outside by the voter. They will be sent to the recorder's office to decide which ones to accept or not accept. Okay, that's sort of an outline. Now let's go to the double vote issue, which I didn't show yet. There are 12 double votes sitting on top. Those are in addition. And they were, of course, sprinkled among the consecutive number register for, I just sorted them to the top so you can see where they are. There are 883 unique names up to that point. And there were 895 ballots cast by my tally and by the election workers' tally. So what we have here are 12 more ballots in the box than there are names of voters who are supposed to have cast these votes. This is prima facie evidence of 12 double votes, which are each one a felony. But then there was another curiosity here. On this signature roster, there were 11 blank entries. And I say, what if we took 11 names from the dispossessed, disenfranchised on the left, and put them in that hole there? Then there would be the same number of unique names as there are ballots cast, and no one could prove that there were 12 double votes, but they didn't do that. Had they moved those names over there, I wouldn't have discovered this aspect of their playbook, and I think the reason they didn't do it was that my friend John Brakey picked up the tear sheets early in the day when the blanks were still on the tear sheets. They didn't understand how theory of their playbook, and they were afraid that if they filled in the names after the blanks were discovered, it would be a bad thing, and so they didn't do it, and so I think they're discovered here. Meantime, these other 22 ballots have disappeared. They are not officially accounted for on my tally or by the poll workers' tally. I'm guessing that they used early mail-in ballots, which you could get extras. You can say you spoiled your first one. John Brakey's wife did that, and they sent her another one without demanding the first one back. So extra ballots can be floating around and could have accounted for this. Those voters thought they voted and their votes were discarded. Okay, now let's finish this up with the provisional ballot fraud. Let's see what happens here. We get these 48 go through normally, another 10 from there, and they get sent and one below. But now we have 38 of them by tally sheet, by balance sheet, doing like an accountant. This is not statistics. 38 ballots went in there, and more than that. Okay, just repeating that. But more than that, when I checked the names that were signed on the provisional ballot roster, 39 of the 51 names signed there were by voters from outside of the precinct. And under Arizona rules, similar to a lot of other states, if you voted outside of your precinct, your vote would not have counted. So they would not have been counted by the recorder, but the recorder didn't get to see them. The poll workers fed them directly into the box. I suspect that these out-of-precinct voters were known to the poll workers, were collaborating with the poll workers, and the poll workers knew which ballots they were to open up if they happened to got sealed, because they were the only ones, virtually, that signed the provisional ballot signature roster, and they directed the rest of the people to sign the regular one. Okay, so sort of the sum of all frauds, so we can add these things up. Disenfranchised voters, they didn't get to vote. We assume they were all carry ballots that are ultimately destroyed. Voters who didn't sign any roster but whose ballots were still counted, I'm guessing that they were cast for Bush. The double votes you saw were undoubtedly all for Bush. Then they created 11 spoils to balance 12 of the double votes, which may either mean that it was sort of a decoy, figuring that we could never prove single double vote or that there was actually a true double vote in there by some voter. We assume those are for Bush. The 38 illegally scanned on election day, assume those were for Bush. 38 adds up to the rest to get 116, and that's a 13.1% swing that that thing could carry to in the extreme. And we found other frauds from interviewing people that maybe could add up to more things. So here I sort of fantasize, I've seen a lot of evidence now today of hacking of central tabulators that could account for these swings, but here in Florida, the 25 smallest counties that use optical scan machines have this particular anomaly here where the registration is about 20% to Republican and the voting is about 70% for Bush. And this is allegedly the Dixiecrat effect, but in Arizona, I don't know of any Dixiecrats, but I think I know of some criminal poll workers. Thanks for your attention.
To close out the evening, Bob Fotrakis is not only critically important to the continuing fight in Ohio, but he is pivotal to this conference occurring because when we were looking for some sponsor, freepress.org stepped up. And
okay, again, it's a great pleasure to be here. I understand that Richard Hayes Phillips already gave my speech, so. and I'd also, Brad of the Brad blog has been writing the stuff that the Free Press hasn't been getting around to because we're working on a book of documents. I was editing the introduction on the plane in, and those of you who are giving the presentations today, I'd really like your permission. Send that to us electronically, truth@freepress.org. I still have room after watching what you were doing here to get that into the book. And it's going to be 400 to 500 pages long. Some of you may know, of course, that the Akron Beacon Journal actually broke through the silence and pointed out that statisticians said it was 1 in 959,000 that the exit polls would be so off in the national election. So as that begins to unravel, on the other side, Dan Takagi, who teaches Moritz College of Law, said exit polls don't matter, although he admits he's had no statistical training in exit polls, but he is a law degree. And I say that as somebody with a PhD and a law degree, and somebody who's taken 20 hours, done polling, been in refereed journals, and I don't call myself a statistical expert, but Dan Takagi is an expert. Go ahead and ask him. Much like as the Brad blog reported, of course, that Mark Hearn, or Thor Hearn, or as he's known in Ohio, Whore Hearn, because he is... to voting rights, what Jeff Gannon is to reporting, right? The president's chief counsel suddenly shows up as the American Center for Voting Rights. This is much like bankruptcy, right? Bankruptcy protection and consumer credit. You know the little people are about to get it, right? Or Clear Skies. The whole Orwellian doublespeak, and now we have Thor Hearn, or Whore Hearn, running amok, going around, masquerading. But with that in mind, again, we do have the Burkett video with a label on it and the testimony from the original public hearing. Also, the Free Press is here, and you might want to look. I'm proud of the muck there, showing how the Bush family had been involved over the years in rigging elections in the Third World with their friends. And part of the assumption we're dealing with is, hi, we only, if we go back, of course, to the church committee, we only rigged 500 or 600 elections in the Third World. We would never think of doing it in Florida or Ohio or Georgia. You know, we just do that in Greece and in Australia and create whole groups, you know, UNO, in places like Nicaragua. but we would never do it here. That would be wrong. Now, with that in mind, let me, I know it's late, and it's actually, I hadn't realized on Central Time, so it's even later for me. First of all, I'd like us all to give ourselves a hand. We're here, we're not going away, and let's go. I got the press release, and it said, most important meeting since 1775. Having just lectured on the Second Continental Congress on my day job, I'm going, that's sort of a bold statement. But on the other hand, it's true, right? Because in the beginning of the Second Continental Congress in 1775, it started out they were seeking better relations with England. A year later, on July 4th, they decided that they needed to take a stand and separate. And that's exactly what we have to do from the mainstream of Republicans and the mainstream of Democrats who want to pretend that what happened on Election Day didn't actually happen. They want to pretend that Karen Hughes did not go to the president and tell him he lost. They want to pretend that Harris did not call the election for Kerry. They want to pretend that Zogby didn't predict an electoral landslide. They want to pretend that the exit polls are so off they make absolutely no sense, so they have to come up with the bizarrest sort of scenarios. Well, let's see, Republican women were anxious in the morning and not very shy, but suddenly they got shy in the afternoon. And that only in Republican counties, because they get shy around other Republican women. And then 80% of the undecided showed up and voted for the president, which anybody who knows politics did not happen. And then you got Karl Rove. There was this mythical outpouring of this sort of vote that came in at the last second with appellations coming out. It's just that nobody saw it. And then in order to get to it, as Richard Hayes Phillips pointed out, you got to say, well, there was a 98.55% voter turnout in South Concord. That is, out of 689 people, 679 voted, and there were no absentees and there were no provisionals. But then you go and canvass the area, you know, for a few hours, and you already find 25 people to say, hell, I didn't vote on Election Day. But that makes you a conspiracy theorist, right? You know, these coincidence theorists, well, the server just went down at 6:30, right at the close of polls, and then suddenly, coincidentally, there was a huge shift. And on the other hand, coincidentally, private companies that backed the president have taken our right to vote secretly and transformed it into their right to count our ballots secretly, and we trust them, even though Wally O'Dell is a ranger and a pioneer, and he raised over $100,000 for the president and had his home in Upper Arlington rezoned for Republican fundraisers. Just trust Wally. Now, we know these things, and they call us conspiracy theorists, but this is good. The last time they called me a conspiracy theorist is when I said that Southern Air Transport was running drugs into Columbus. The Tragus is a conspiracy theorist. Well, I'm hearing it from the FBI. I'm hearing it from the sheriff. They went bankrupt. $20 million later, they went bankrupt after the CIA Inspector General said, by the way, they happen to have 12 pilots that run drugs. I said Governor Voinovich's brother was linked to the mob and steering contracts. Conspiracy theory. Until we bankrupt the Voinovich company. And the governor would have went down had he not had his hearing aid off when he was informed to launder money. So they're calling us conspiracy theorists. Why? Because we have facts and we're smart enough to put them together, and we're smart enough to realize is that if Diebold makes every single ATM machine that they have with a paper trail, suddenly they can't make their voting machines with a paper trail. This is the most important meeting since 1775. Thus, our quest here, we are driven to state candidly to the world the facts that propel us to complete the American Revolution. Because that is what is happening here. That is what this event is about. That we hold these truths to be self-evident. That we have the right to life, liberty, and a fair vote count. Because that is a sacred right. And these people that came out of the CIA, like Bush the Elder, who know about demonstration democracy, who know about putting the Karzais of the world from Unocal, pipeline consultant, to president of Kabul, is that they want to pretend that these facts aren't out there. But they are. We know what we're doing here. We are going to complete the American Revolution. We know the task at hand. We know what they've done. We are documenting it over and over again. We know what's before us. And let me end by saying, if we think about this task at hand, we know that if we are true, that if we keep the faith, that if we endure, as they did in Seneca Falls in 1848, as they did in Greensboro in 1960 when they demanded that cup of coffee, as they did with young people who stood up against the barbary of the Vietnam War, if we keep the faith and don't listen to their versions of history, and their version of history is then women got the right to vote. 1920, men granted them the right to vote. Wrong. People from below rose up, demonstrated, protested, chained themselves to the White House fence, and won the right to vote, just as we shall win the right to a fair vote count in America, full transparency in this election, and we will complete the American Revolution. All power to the people. Fight on.
I go home now.
That's right. That's a good idea.
Thanks kindly, folks. We'll see you bright and early around 8:30, I think, is when we're kicking off in the morning. So sleep tight for whatever 5 or 6 hours we have, and we'll see you back shortly.